Gazette for this Thursday, June 25th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can expect the weather today to be between 84 and 68, and we'll have mostly sunny skies. We turn to today's front page for a technology and agriculture story by Aaron Jordan. In tough times, some farmers turn to more tech. This is from Ainsworth. More than 100 farmers and agricultural retailers from Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and California came last week to Washington County to learn more about soil health. The stars of the Ag Field Day were drones that can drop cover crop seeds and spray chemicals with pinpoint precision and without trampling plants already in the field. Michael Ott, Chief Executive Officer of Rentizo, the Iowa City company that sells the drone systems, expects he'll sell a large number of drones because of the field day, with most going to ag retailers who will then offer the drone service to farmers in their areas. Ott said, "We're working with people who want to optimize their systems. For a long time it was yield, yield, yield. Now, with leaner times, people are looking to optimize. Can I spend less and get the same amount? That's where we come in." This year, with still low commodity prices, continuing trade issues, wavering support of biofuels, and now COVID-19, farmers might not be able to invest as much money into new equipment, gadgets, or computer systems. But they are looking for ways technology can help them improve operations without spending more cash, said Matt Darr, director of the Iowa State University's BioCentury Research Farm and professor and Kinsey Manufacturing Fellow in the College of Engineering. Another change this year is the ease of access to digital information, Darr said. Farmers no longer have to carry a USB drive and have a minor in computer science to use data coming from weather satellites, drones, or other smart tractor, or their smart tractor. Companies have improved data visualization and made it accessible on tablets or phones out in the field. Darr said, "The easier it is to engage with the information and access it locally, the more you can translate that raw information into new practices." Ott said his drone technology can save money. With a drone, he can spray fungicide on just the high-producing section of a field to get maximum yield as opposed to dousing the whole field. One Rentizo customer with an oddly shaped field wants chemicals dispensed only on the inner rows, which can be done with a drone. Ott said he won't spray the outer three rows of anything because raccoon, deer, and beaver eat those. He said, "I'm not going to waste any chemicals." Drones also make it possible to seed or spray at any time, even when the ground is wet or crops already are growing. Rentizo this week won the Ag Tech and Biotech Company of the Year award presented by the Technology Association of Iowa, according to a tweet Monday. Some Iowa farmers at the field day enjoyed seeing Rentizo drones and a Montag interseeder mounted on a rotary hoe, but they don't expect to be using the technology soon, said Kevin Reed, 47, of Washington County. "Not everything they demonstrate here is worth doing." He noted that the aerial application of a cover crop seed mix between rows of corn would require rain for the seed to germinate. "This will all be for nothing if it doesn't rain." Reed and Joe Stoddard, who is in his 60s, plan to use their existing equipment to plant cover crops as a way to improve soil health. Stoddard said, "1,000 years from now, we'll still need to eat. We need to make the soil more productive." In most cases, farmers plant cover crops not to glean a harvest, but to protect soil from erosion, break up compacted soil, and absorb nitrate and phosphorus. The cover crop, often rye, is killed off with herbicide before the spring planting of corn and soybeans. Iowa had 907,000 acres planted in cover crops during the 2017-2018 winter season, or about 3.9% of all farmed acres, according to the Washington, D.C.-based Environmental Working Group's 2017 cover crop study of Iowa, Illinois, and Indiana. In those states, including Iowa, cover crop growth is heavily subsidized by the state and federal government in the hopes of encouraging farmers to try proven conservation methods. Stoddard doesn't think the government should provide cost share, saying the farmer is the one responsible for his or her field and will reap the benefits of healthier soil that can grow more food. Eric Anderson, 59, drove from Dyke to learn how to get better at growing a diverse mix of cover crops, including clover, flax, hairy vetch, or radishes. Radishes and turnips can break up soil compaction, he said. Efforts to improve soil health maybe won't be cost-effective next year, but it will bring value year after year. Anderson, who farms the land once farmed by his father and grandfather, acknowledges it's difficult to change gears from the past, when farmers were convinced tilling improved the soil. New research shows leaving living roots intact throughout the year increases water filtration, boosts healthy bacteria, and reduces weeds. Field days such as this provide an opportunity for farmers to see new methods in practice. Mitchell Ora, the Washington County farmer and Continuum Ag owner who hosted the field day, was keen to show visitors his cornfields that leave every third row empty to cover crops that can be seeded in the gaps. "I'm suppressing weeds and keeping the soil," Ora said, adding that last year the field saw no yield decrease despite having less corn planted. "It worked really slick," he said. The article is accompanied by a picture of on the front page of a crowd watching a seemingly large drone being commanded by one of the members of the company offering that service. And there's another picture of Michael Ott, the chief executor of Rantizo, the drone offering service. And there's a picture of a drone hovering over a green leafy crop, and a final picture of Ott pouring seed into a dispersion canister on a grounded drone. Also on the front page, Johnson County's virus spike skews younger, reported by Michaela Rahm from Iowa City. After several weeks of a steady downward trend, Johnson County has seen a swift uptick in residents testing positive for the novel coronavirus this past week. Public health and local health care officials say the spikes in these cases have been identified among a younger demographic and most likely are tied to the loosening of certain pandemic-related mitigation efforts, including the reopening of bars and restaurants. Starting the week of June 14, Johnson County began seeing double-digit increases in COVID-19 cases. By Sunday, June 20, the county saw the highest single-day increase since mid-April and the second-highest single-day total since Johnson County began reporting cases on March 8th. The University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics also recorded a significant increase in individuals being screened through its virtual clinic for influenza-like illness in the past week. On Wednesday, 247 patients were screened for coronavirus-like symptoms, a number that has been trickling upward since the beginning of this month. On June 1, 52 people were screened through the clinic. But what is causing the number of positive cases suddenly to increase locally? Countywide, the age range among this past increase in cases varies from 4 to 68 years old, with the average age of 24, said Sam Jarvis, community health manager at Johnson County Public Health. UIHC providers are seeing new cases concentrated among those ages 18 to 24, said Dr. Jorge Salinas, UIHC infectious disease specialist. Many of them, he added, work in the service industry. It is possible, Salinas said, that the new cases could be related to the reopening of certain businesses in Iowa, especially bars and restaurants. Governor Kim Reynolds ordered bars, among other businesses, could reopen using certain precautions starting June 1st. Bars and restaurants could open completely without restrictions June 12th. Businesses reopening coupled with the warming weather has led the county's disease investigations teams to note that younger people are being more active and social at this time. Jarvis told the Associated Press this week, "As we saw those restrictions being lifted, thinking about your average incubation period and things, you know, I think we're definitely seeing the result of that." Several of the young adults associated with the new Johnson County cases have been gathering in establishments that increase their risk of acquiring COVID-19, Salinas said. Many of them, likely because of their age, tend to socialize and visit venues where transmission of COVID-19 may be more likely, such as indoor spaces that are crowded, Salinas said. So I see that pattern. Jarvis, however, told the Gazette that it's impossible to know the exact place or event with so many factors involved. Is it due to not physically distancing? Is it due to not wearing a mask in public? Are persons not implementing those precautions while out in public? Is it due to restrictions being lifted? More than likely a combination of all the above, Jarvis said. Story County, home of the Iowa State University in Ames, also has reported an increase in cases among adults ages 19 to 25. The upward trend began 2 weeks ago and by Wednesday reached 542 positive cases. The director of Story County Public Health, Les White, told the Associated Press that it's a group that is very social in settings where masks and social distancing is not occurring. Jarvis said, "We've been in contact with emergency management and public health in Story County, but mostly in terms of planning for contact tracing. The cause of the spike could be the same, but we don't have that level of understanding yet." The protests happening in Iowa City and across the rest of the state also are considered by officials as a factor. However, Selena said, there is less risk for transmission when individuals are outdoors. "We've had protests throughout the United States, and not all the places, even if they have large protests, have seen increases in cases," Selena said. In New York City, for example, the numbers continue going down, so it's not clear that protests have played a significant role in the increase of cases. The increased case count also could be associated with the increased testing capacity, some theorized. Testing is conducted on every patient before surgery and on every patient before he or she is admitted into Mercy, Iowa City, meaning healthcare providers have been finding more cases, spokeswoman Margaret Reese said. Whatever the reason, Mercy, Iowa City officials are paying close attention, she said. The spike in positive tests is leaving local officials worried. Hospital officials have not seen an increase in serious illness or hospitalizations, but if the spread is not contained, it's only a matter of time before these individuals spread the virus to more vulnerable populations, Selena said. Young adults aren't immune to serious illness from COVID-19, Salinas added, noting there are cases of children and young adults dying as a result of the virus. Hospital officials feel better prepared for a spike in COVID-19 cases than they did in March, but Salinas said it's still important that residents maintain good public health practices to keep others around them healthy. That includes washing hands frequently, wearing a face covering when in public, and maintaining at least 6 feet of distance. The name of the game is solidarity, Selena said on Facebook. If we all work together as a pack, the chances of winning are much higher than if we take an individualist approach. The article is accompanied by a bar graph showing the various stages of COVID-19 illness every day from June 1st to June 24th, and obviously with June 23rd and 24th being a significantly higher and longer bar. And the third story on the front page, UI students screaming, wanting to come back, reported by Vanessa Miller, and it's from Iowa City. After last week unveiling that a plan to safely return to 30,000-plus students, return 30,000-plus students to campus this fall includes switching to online-only classes after Thanksgiving, a University of Iowa leader said Wednesday the school plans to resume offering in-person classes in spring 2021. Of course, administrators warned during a live online update Wednesday afternoon, which remains unknown about how the coronavirus pandemic will progress in the coming months on reopened businesses or campuses like the UI, which in March sent home more than 30,600 students and directed faculty and staff to teach the remainder of the term virtually. People worry about the flu curve, and when that introduces, where will we be with either second or third waves if that happens with COVID and a vaccine and medicines, Rod Leonards, Senior Vice President of UI Finance and Operations, said during the campus update. He said in a response to a question about spring 2021, "It's a very unpredictable future at this point, but the university does at this point plan to have face-to-face. We will continue to evaluate back-up options as we go into, through, and beyond the fall semester." UI President Bruce Harold said during the forum that our students are screaming, wanting to come back. "We must get back to running our residence halls," he said, "but we really need their help because not only all of us, but all of them are also going to need to change their behavior." Spelling out in broad strokes some of those changes, Harold and Leonards pulled highlights of the return to campus plan released last week, including required use of masks, social distancing, and new safety protocols and procedures for students, faculty, and staff. Harold said, "Some of you may be wondering about this issue of wearing masks and how we change some of the behaviors. Will the students come along? And I will simply say they have to come along or we keep the whole camp, so we keep the whole campus safe." Between now and the start of classes, August 24, the UI is holding a series of student, faculty, and staff trainings on expectations for the fall. The leaders Wednesday didn't talk about enforcement should students rebuff face covering requirements, for example. The campus plan does, however, mention use of a student agreement, quote, "regarding expectations for compliance," unquote, before starting the fall semester. And the plan reports the UI Code of Student Life includes rules and procedures, quote, "regarding student behavior, expectations, and accountability that help reduce the spread of COVID-19, unquote. Iowa's other public universities, Iowa State University and the University of Northern Iowa, also last spring curtailed in-person instruction, kept courses online over the summer, and planned to bring students back in the fall, although under an academic calendar that starts and ends the fall semester earlier. UI leaders Wednesday prided themselves for charting their own course for an unprecedented return, not just mimicking what other schools around the country have decided. Harold said, "In my opinion, I think many of our peers have not done that very well as it relates to reopening. Instead, they seem to be moving like lemmings, and just because one university does something, it must be okay, because they clearly must have thought it through, and so then a second institution picks it up and does something similar." But Harold stressed impact from the virus is not the same from coast to coast or even across Iowa, and his campus's approach mirrors that. "Just because one institution decided to go online for the entire year, we didn't emulate that," he said. "We didn't decide that our calendar should be just the same as other institutions." We specifically got people together and empowered a group of those experts from across our campus to work through every nuance and specifically address how the University of Iowa should reopen, he said. Not the entire regential system, not the privates in Iowa, not Notre Dame, not Purdue, not Indiana, but Iowa. In announcing plans to return students for the fall, ISU earlier this month said it would bring students back a week early, keep them in class on Labor Day, and truncate finals week to end the fall semester before Thanksgiving. Hours later, UNI said it would follow the same calendar, with officials noting they wanted to avoid bringing students back to campus after a risky holiday travel. The UIA, a week later, said it would follow its original schedule, starting classes August 24 and ending fall finals the week of December 18, but its post-Thanksgiving portion would go online. UI officials said Wednesday that although the residence hall system will remain open for students needing to stay, moving courses online will avoid the potential for more COVID-19 travel-related spread. And Harrell said keeping the semester start where it was accommodates student summer employment. He said, "The one thing we heard over and over again from a number of our students was that they now have summer internships or summer jobs, and so moving the start of classes up a week or two just seemed to be incredibly economically disruptive to some." The campus update came less than an hour after Harrell participated in an economic review panel hosted by the Corridor Business Journal. Although UI's fall plan is not specific on health screening details, Harrell said during the panel his campus will conduct testing in residence halls. Harrell also said his campus is testing football players daily. If one were to test positive, that means eight or more others would need to be isolated, making quarantine math somewhat complicated, especially when officials think about packing stadiums and arenas with fans. He expected that the UI will offer some sort of athletics this coming academic year, but said the experience will be different, like a shortened season, perhaps. Looking at the Insight page, the Gazette's editorial, "Turn Focus from Prisons to Police." Governor Kim Reynolds last year appointed a committee to study criminal justice reform. The group's focus so far has been on helping prisoners re-enter life on the outside, part of what Reynolds calls, quote, "the power of redemption and second chances," unquote. That's important work, and the governor's focus committee on criminal justice has shown promising early results. Its first set of recommendations, released last December, has laudable planks regarding prison discharge, education programming, and behavioral health treatment. But this moment, when Iowans are witnessing an unprecedented series of mass protests against racism and police violence, demands a wider focus than reacclimating former inmates to productive society. We must scrutinize the whole system, starting with police interactions with the public. The police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis last month was a turning point in the movement for racial justice and police accountability. That was only possible because an onlooker gathered disturbing video footage of the scene. This underscores the unique power of video technology to make police work more transparent. Police body cameras have become common in Iowa, with most large departments now outfitting officers with the devices. However, open records laws have lagged behind the technology. Without strong and consistent rules requiring the prompt disclosure of police body camera footage, Americans instead rely on cell phone videos captured by civilians. In several Iowa cases, families and justice advocates have been forced into drawn-out legal battles to secure the release of important video footage months after controversial incidents. Just this week, a judge in Jackson County determined Maquoketa police body camera footage should be released in a case involving the traffic stop of an assistant county attorney. Meanwhile, the Polk County Sheriff's Office continues to fight a lawsuit seeking to release of basic details, including dash and body camera video in the July 2018 death of Isaiah Hayes, who was shot and killed by a Polk County Sheriff's deputy following a pursuit. When police departments maintain their own video footage and establish their own disclosure rules, they maintain an undue balance of power over the public. A 2016 national survey of prosecutors in jurisdictions with police body cameras found 93% had used body camera footage to prosecute citizens, while only 8% had used the footage to prosecute police officers. Policymakers have known for some time about the need to hone camera regulations. In the Iowa legislature, there have been proposals to require departments to equip officers with cameras, and a proposal to require the release of more body camera footage. Iowans would be well served if Reynolds calls on her Justice Reform Committee to develop video disclosure recommendations. The newly formed Law Enforcement Vision for Equality Task Force, a collaboration between the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP and the Iowa Police Chiefs Association, also could have valuable input. Body cameras alone are not a solution to police misconduct, but strong transparency rules are a necessary precursor to building public trust in law enforcement. And that is today's Gazette editorial. And Todd Dorman has his 24-hour Dorman column, Cedar Rapids Council Finds Its Destination. Cedar Rapids City Council member Ann Poe remembers the long drive back from Council Bluffs in April 2014 after the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission shot down the city's plan for a casino. No slots, no steakhouse, no dice. Poe said during Tuesday afternoon's virtual City Council meeting, recounting how, upon returning to the city, dejected city officials drove past the corner of First Street and First Avenue on the west side of downtown where Cedar Crossing Casino had been planned. Poe said, "We were just heartbroken. You know, whatever goes here, it has to be great," Poe recalled saying at the time. Over the next 6 years, there would be another ill-fated push for a casino and plenty of ideas on what should be built on 8 acres of empty land in the center of town, adjacent to Interstate 380. "We've had master developers and steering committees and an open house last fall where citizens were asked for their opinions. Should we be the Milwaukee, Riverwalk, or maybe Plaza del Sol in Barcelona?" On Tuesday evening, the council finally arrived at its destination development, voting to start negotiations with First and First LLC, a group of local investors including Joe Amon, Chad Pelley, former NFL kicker Nate Keating, and restaurateur Matt Smith. They're planning a $90 million to $100 million development featuring a Big Grove Brewery, a family fun center with bowling and other activities, a movie theater, mixed-use space including housing, and a parking complex. Council members appearing in the little stacked video boxes of a socially distanced Zoom meeting put their faith in the novel notion we all will eventually leave our own pandemic boxes and have some family fun. They're also betting that the economic downturn and uncertainty spawned by COVID-19 won't scuttle or downsize the ambitious project. "And you thought there wasn't any high-stakes gambling in Cedar Rapids? With everything going on, there's still a lot of positivity about the project," Amon told the council Tuesday, insisting all the project's major pieces remain in place. There were impressive renderings of a vibrant development, but many, many details still are to be worked out. For one thing, what will the city's role be in aiding the project? City council members wondered about what sort of housing would be included, how the parking garage might look, and how much bling would be visible from the interstate. A development agreement still must be negotiated. "It's my belief that by the time we finish, it will probably look different," council member Dale Todd said. "I look at this as a journey." "Granted, but let's hope it's not too different. We've seen pretty renderings fade before. Westdale was going to be a green space-laden lifestyle center. Reality is concrete, discount stores, and storage. But as council members pointed out repeatedly Tuesday, the First and First Development Group is filled with locals who have a successful track record. So members backed moving ahead 8-0, with Mayor Brad Hart recused. So maybe something truly great will happen at the corner. At least we don't have to go to Council Bluffs to find out. That was Todd Dorman's 24-hour Dorman column. And we have two community letters today. The first is from Stacy Van Zant from Iowa City. Make Juneteenth a national holiday. Americans have recognized July 4th as a national day of celebration of our independence for over 240 years. This, however, is not true for all Americans, and it is a time we recognized this truth. Juneteenth should also be recognized as a national day of celebration, a day when the people who played such a big part in building this nation were finally freed. Doing so would be a small gesture that could go a long way toward building a more inclusive cultural identity in America. That was the letter by Stacy Van Zant of Iowa City, and our second letter is from Cindy Golding of Cedar Rapids. Anti-ethanol group supports Finkenauer. U.S. Representative Abby Finkenauer owes Iowans, particularly farmers, an explanation as to what promises she made to get the endorsement of the liberal environmental group, the Sierra Club. I understand she needs their support to receive more national donations, but when more than 85% of her money comes from outside of Iowa, I have grave concerns about exactly who she is representing. As a farmer in Linn County, I'm worried about the Sierra Club influence, an unapologetically anti-ethanol group that supports the Green New Deal. In a recent story, Finkenauer reportedly did not respond to a request for comment. That isn't good enough for Iowa farmers, and that's why I'll be supporting Ashley Hinson in November. That was the letter by Cindy Golding of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for this Thursday, June 25th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries, and among our other notices from Cedar Rapids, Susan Moran, 78, died Tuesday, June 23rd, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. From Maquoketa, James Jim Arterberry, 74, died Tuesday, June 23, Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. From Vinton, Dick Davis, 94, died Wednesday, June 24, the Van Steenhuis Russell Funeral Home, Vinton. From Waukon, Ann C. Kensky Ewing, 62, died Monday, June 22, Martin Funeral Home, Waukon. Now, among our regular obituaries, from Cedar Rapids, Lena M., known as Donna Haas, 89, died Tuesday, June 23rd. Services are private burial at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Cedar Memorial is in charge of the arrangements. Memorials may be directed on behalf of Lena M. Donna Haas to the Alzheimer's Association in her memory. From Cedar Rapids, Joel Robert Herman, 64, formerly of Storm Lake, passed away in his home on June 16 of natural causes. Private service will be held at St. Paul's Methodist Chapel. Memorials may be directed, if you wish, to the United Methodist Church, 211 3rd Street, Storm Lake, Iowa, 50588, the Methwick Foundation, or Camp Courageous. From Williamsburg, William Bill Mac F. McMosley, 73, passed away peacefully on Tuesday, June 23rd. Graveside services will be held 3 p.m. Saturday, June 27, at Pleasant Hill Cemetery in Blairstown. Visitation 1 to 2:45 p.m. Saturday at the Phillips Funeral Home in Blairstown. In lieu of flowers, memorials in memory of William Bill Mack F. McMosley may be made to the family for a scholarship fund for young musicians in William's name. Online condolences, PhillipsFuneralHomes.com. From Palo, Gage Bryant Underwood, 18, passed away on Friday, March 27, at his home. Visitation 4 to 8 p.m. Monday, June 29, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. COVID-19 restrictions and recommendations for gathering will be observed at that time. Funeral services 11 a.m. Tuesday, June 30, at Cedar Hills Community Church on E Avenue Northwest, Cedar Rapids. The family will greet friends 9:30 to 11 at the church. A mask is encouraged and social distancing recommended. Burial will follow at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Memorials may be directed to the family. You can please leave a message, tribute, or memory Gage Bryant Underwood at the cedarmemorial.com website. From Spillville, Jennifer Lynn Ira, and her previous name is Federn. Jennifer Lynn Federn Ira, 52, formerly of Spillville, passed away peacefully on Friday, June 19, at her home in rural New Hampton, alongside her husband and daughters. Celebration of life will be held at the Inwood Ballroom in Spillville the evening of August 15. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the family in memory of Jennifer. From Festus, Missouri, Cindy Lewis Garbers, 67, of Festus, passed away on Friday, June 19, at Mercy Jefferson Hospital in Crystal City, Missouri. Visitation was held June 23rd at Mon Twin City Chapel in Festus, Missouri. Cindy will be cremated, then buried with her son Michael at Evergreen Cemetery in Vinton, Iowa, on Saturday, June 27. In lieu of flowers, contributions may be made to Festus Manor, Festus, Missouri, and where Cindy resided. Arrangements are under the direction of the Mon Funeral Home, Twin City Chapel, Festus, Missouri. And finally, from Glen Carbon, Illinois, Ron Swanson, 81, formerly of Marion, Iowa, passed away peacefully on June 21st at his home in Glen Carbon, Illinois, after a six-year battle with ALS. Private graveside service officiated by Pastor Steve Qualbin will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, June 27, at Oak Shade Cemetery in Marion, followed by a public visitation from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at St. Mark's Lutheran Church on C Avenue in Marion. Masks must be worn to enter the church. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to ALS Association St. Louis Regional Chapter, St. Mark's Lutheran Church, or Vitas Healthcare. And that would has a website, Vitas, V-I-T-A-S, Vitas Community Connection.org. And we turn to the sports page. Headline, East Iowa Power Split. High school softball story by Jeff Linder. Dateline Iowa City, Mary Christofiak and Madison LeClaire had a heart-to-heart after last season. The number three pitcher on Cedar Rapids Kennedy staff, behind a pair of first-team All-Staters, Christofiak asked her coach whether she should concentrate on another aspect of her game. LeClaire's response, "I told her to see her potential. I see the competitor she is," LeClaire said. "I told her, just keep throwing for me. Last night it became obvious that was a good call." Christofiak got the start at the opener of the Cougars Mississippi Valley Conference cross-divisional softball showdown with Iowa City High and came through with five gutsy innings to lift Class 5A No. 4 Kennedy to a 2-1 win. City High, ranked number 2 in 5A, won the nightcap 12-1 in 5 innings. The article is accompanied by a picture of Cedar Rapids Kennedy's Addie Parker preparing to slide into home plate as Iowa City High's Carrie Koenig makes a catch to get her out in the first game of their doubleheader last night at Iowa City High School. And a second picture of Cedar Rapids Kennedy's Addie Alber celebrating a home run Wednesday with teammate Mary Christofiak. And on the second page, Jeff Linder reports the high school softball notebook, multiple milestones for Flanagan. There was a time back when schools played a full season plus with a 50-game summer regular season in which 100-win softball pitchers were common. Now it's more of a trickle, 2 or 3 per year in the state. This year, Abby Flanagan is one of them. A senior at North Lynn, Flanagan hit the 100 victory plateau Thursday when the Class 2A top-ranked Lynx handled Starmont. 2 days later, she recorded her 1,000th career strikeout in a sweep of West Delaware. Said Flanagan, a senior who will play softball next year at Des Moines Area Community College, "I'm pretty happy to get both of those close together. I didn't think it would work out like that, but it did." Flanagan is 7-0 this season, 102-22 in her career, heading into last night's game at Dubuque-Wallert. Virtually every pitch in that span has been thrown to her twin catcher, Grace Flanagan. Flanagan said, "Having Grace around has made it a lot easier. She's able to practice at home with me, and that makes it a lot easier." The Flanagan's pitching and catching routine began in elementary school. At that time, the rise ball has become Abby's trademark pitch. "It's definitely the pitch that moves the most," she said. Flanagan became the program's ace as an 8th grader, chalking up a 23-9 record. Then it was 19-8 as a freshman, 24-3 as a sophomore, and 29-2 as a junior when the Lynx captured the Class 2A state championship. North Lynn is 8-0 this season, 6-0 in Tri-Rivers Conference, and on a 14-game win streak heading into Wednesday's game. The article is accompanied by a picture of Abby Flanagan. Benton Community Coach Eric Stenberg picked up win number 200 and 201 when the Bobcats swept Clear Creek Amana 1-0 and 8-6 on Tuesday at Oxford. Stenberg is in his 7th season with the Bobcats and owns a 201-59 mark, highlighted by a 42-2 campaign in 2016 that was climaxed by a Class 3A state championship. Benton was the 3A runner-up in 2015. This year's softball squad is 4-2. And a third item in the notebook column. As of Wednesday morning, Lynn Mars Kennedy Rensselaer ranked 2nd in the state in batting average at 846, collecting 11 hits in 13 at-bats. Cedar Rapids Kennedy's Addie Alber, 1.636, and Iowa City High's Kelly Potter, 1.500, were 2nd and 4th in slugging percentage. 6 area teams, Cedar Rapids Kennedy, Linmar, North Lynn, Jessup, MFL, Marmack, and Turkey Valley, are among 35 in the state that were undefeated through Tuesday. And some items from the high school baseball notebook reported by K.J. Pilcher. 8-0 Warriors wasting little time. South Winneshiek has produced its best start since 2014. The Warriors returned 11 letter winners and all but one player from last year's state quarterfinal team. They have their sights set on another postseason run that ends in Des Moines, which would be the program's 3rd and 1st back-to-back trips, said South Winneshiek coach Alex Smith, who noted the Warriors started 18-0 in 2014. They have big expectations and high goals for themselves and the program. I tell them our goal every year is to play our best baseball at the end of the season and hope for the best. It fuels their motivation to get back down to state. It is somewhere they want to see themselves, and that experience gives them a great deal of confidence. The Warriors are ranked fourth in Class 1A, opening with an 8-0 mark. Strong pitching and defense has limited teams to less than a run a game, while the offense scores at a 7.5 run per game clip. Another item, for the first time in 3 years of its existence, Iowa City Liberty has its own home baseball field. The Lightning now have a facility on the school grounds just north of the softball field and football stadium. Last season, Liberty played its home games at Mount Mercy University's Plaster Athletic Complex. No more commuting to host opponents, including some who had a shorter trip to the field. Just having all our fans here, Liberty senior Tyler Dom said, they don't have to travel 30 minutes to go to a home game, Liberty senior Tyler Dom said. The Lightning received votes in the Class 4A preseason rankings and are 5-1 overall. They own a 4-1 home record during a 7-game homestand that concludes with Mississippi Valley Conference doubleheader against Cedar Rapids Kennedy 4-0 tonight. And another item, Cedar Rapids Prairie broke into the win column Tuesday and accomplished that in impressive fashion. The Hawks racked up 26 runs on 23 hits in a doubleheader sweep over Cedar Rapids, Washington. Prairie improved to 2-2, posting 12-2 and 14-2 victories. The article is accompanied by a picture of South Winnipeg's Nick Holian ducking as a teammate Noah Teescotter throws the ball to second base during last year's Class 1A quarterfinal at Principal Park in Des Moines. On the living page, we have a full-page spread and the headline, The Greatest Bar on Earth. Fans organized to save the mill and its storied legacy. Reported by Allison Gowans. Jay Knight has been here before. He remembers well when the mill was slated to close in 2003. The storied Iowa City bar and restaurant first opened in 1962 as the Coffee Mill, a folk music venue and coffee shop, and moved to its current Burlington Street location in 1972. Knight had been running weekly open mic nights there since 1981, when owners Keith and Pat Dempster announced they were retiring in 2003, he prepared for one last show. People who had been regulars had moved away, had traveled from other states to be there. He filled 22 performance slots instead of the normal 8. It was a giant party. We just had the place packed. There was filming going on. People were putting up posters from over the years. It was a great night, he said. Then, at literally the 11th hour, around 11 p.m., someone came and whispered in his ear that the bar had been saved. New owners Marty Christensen and Dan Overson stepped in to buy the business. The bar closed for only about a month for some remodeling before reopening in July 2003, and open mic night continued, along with the other things that made the bar in Iowa City mainstay, namely live music, community gatherings, and fundraisers, and nostalgia-laced food and drinks. Then, with 2020, came the coronavirus pandemic and related shutdowns. Though the business initially offered carryout food, the owners announced on Facebook on May 2nd that they would close completely for the time being. That became permanent with an additional post June 18. Quote, after 17 years of keeping the mill going through its 58th year in business, it's time for us to step away. We hope that someone else might want to take over the mission to preserve this institution. It's a cool place and important to a lot of people in Iowa City. Thanks to everyone for their support, unquote. Christensen said in an email that it was time for him to move on. Quote, we've been considering passing the baton for a while. I've been the caretaker of the mill for 17 years, and within a day job, family, etc., it's always been difficult for me to give the mill the attention it deserves, he said, unquote. Immediately after the announcement, people started leaving comments expressing their love of the bar and expressing hopes it could be saved once again. Supporters started two different Facebook groups dedicated to saving the mill. One, Save the Mill, a living landmark, is focused on securing historic landmark status for the building, which is owned by Mark Mohn. Members have been talking with Iowa City Historic Preservation Commission members and collecting research on the building's history. The other, Refounders of the Mill, is a group of mill staff and others hoping to come up with a plan to purchase the business. We love that mill, that the mill has become a safe haven for all backgrounds, and most importantly, self-expression, said Rich LeMay, who has worked at the mill since 2012, most recently booking shows and events. He also founded Run of the Mill Theater Productions, which stages shows there. He said they are hoping to create a work-led co-op structure to purchase the business and run it, perhaps as a non-profit, and still are working on their plans. Christensen said, we certainly do hope that someone buys the mill and keeps it serving the role in the community that it does and has for decades. We've had a lot of interest, and that's exciting. The bar has been a spot where progressive politics, student groups, fundraisers, and community organizers have gathered for decades. Stacy Walker, Linn County Supervisor, said, it's the greatest bar on earth. I've been saying that for years. He recalled spending afternoons studying and reading there as a junior University of Iowa political science student before moving to Washington, D.C. When he moved back to Iowa to work on President Barack Obama's re-election campaign in 2012, he and a friend organized a watch party for the State of Union address in the bar's back room. They created a Facebook event and ordered a few pizzas, thinking just a small group of their friends would show up. Instead, the room was packed with not only political junkies, but also the bar's regular crowd. It was artists, teachers, and writers, musicians. We just had this incredibly diverse back room, he said. I walked up on the stage and said, I don't know what we're going to do with this energy, but we need to do something with it. He passed around a legal pad to collect names and email addresses, and that list became the basis for forming Political Party Live, a group that hosted live political events across the state and later a podcast. He said, we just kind of put all these minds, this brain trust together, and the mill became our spot. They had great food, a great vibe. We knew everyone, we knew the owners, and they trusted us, and it just kind of was our headquarters. Along with the campaign stops, the watch parties and fundraisers and similar events, the bar has been a central part of Iowa City's live music and performing arts scene. Theater companies have made it their home. Stage festivals such as Mission Creek and Witching Hour have hosted shows on its stage, and performers such as Dave Zolo, Greg Brown, and Dave Moore made its stage part of their regular rotations. I could go on about the different shows we had, great employees, celebrations that came in, etc., but the main thing is just those were very rare times when I paused and saw the mill being what it is uniquely, full of people having a great time, he said. I've always felt that I was a caretaker of an institution. The emails, calls, texts, and Facebook comments I've seen make me feel even more that our move to keep the mill open 17 years ago was worthwhile. That was stated by Christensen. And the article is accompanied, as you might expect, by many pictures of both the inside and the outside of a familiar place, that the mill. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for this Thursday, June 25th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.